I'm going to read the theme for the Fellowship of the Spirit. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the Fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Alcoholics Anonymous, page 164. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Cynthia, who is going to lead us off in our prayer.
Thanks, Mark. Cynthia, alcoholic. Dear God, it is I who have made my life a mess. I have done it, but I cannot undo it. My mistakes are mine, and I will begin a searching and fearless moral inventory. I will write down my wrongs, but I will also include that which is good. I pray for the strength to complete this task. God, please help me to be free of anger and to see that the world and its people have dominated me. Show me that the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, have the power to actually kill me. And I'm going to hand it over to Stacy to introduce our speaker, Paula.
Man, Cynthia, killing it with these prayers on specific steps. Wow. Okay, yay. Paula is the, I'm in the middle, man. Mike and Paula, like, just kidnapped me into this world of Zoom, and they know so many people that I am in the middle, and I am so grateful for that. So I'm on page 58 of the 12 and 12. Often it was while working on this step with our sponsors or spiritual advisors that we first felt truly able to forgive others. No matter how deeply we felt they had wronged us, our moral inventory had persuaded us that all-around forgiveness was desirable. But it was only when we resolutely tackled step five that we inwardly knew we were able to receive forgiveness and give it to. I give you Paula.
Thank you, Stacy. Hi, everybody. I'm Paula Parton, and I'm an alcoholic. Coming to you from the middle of the amazing Central Illinois. Come to find out that's a place, so you know. Hopefully, Stacy and her big summer trip is going to be blending here on her way somewhere. I don't know. I was cussed. Oh, my God. So thanks, everybody, for asking me. I want to say that of any Zoom conference or meeting that I've spoken at to date, you guys asked me with the most time. I mean, you asked me what it seemed like in the Zoom world a long time ago. So I appreciate that. What I'm used to being shoulder to shoulder with Mike on these Corona conferences and Zoom conferences is pretty much 2 days, you know, before he needs me to find 50 speakers for him. He'll say, hey, here's the schedule. What do you think? And then, you know, toward the end of this, as my husband's looking at me askance, I'll say something to Mike like, well, you know, I'm not sure I can, you know, help you with that. And it's like he pretends he doesn't hear me. I'm pretty sure is how that goes. And like, look at him. Who could say no? And then like, all you amazing texts on all these things, Mark, I don't know if you remember, but you said I could be your other mother. So don't be forgetting that, because I got a whole list of stuff for you, honey. I love you so much. I'm going to be sending you a little, you know, gift baskets and stuff, because that's a hand sanitizer, because that's what moms do. So
love you so much, Paula.
Honey, stick with me, baby. Don't you worry. We'll get through it. My sobriety date is October 29th, 1979. I took my first drink, which was 3 bottles of wine at once, when I was 14 years old, and my last drink when I was 17 years old. And, you know, before I do a talk or a step or a workshop or whatever, I always pray and, you know, hope that God gives me my words, you know, so we will see where this goes. But I love the 4-step and I love the 5th step. And I've done these workshops on these steps before. And it's funny when I was like thinking over, like, am I going to have a plan or, you know, some notes or what will I do, is when I started, you know, mulling over and thinking about what felt important to me that we'll see if God also feels it's important. It's like nothing like just 2 years ago, I did a workshop on this. You know, it's interesting, right? How it goes. And I think that when I pray, that God provides the words for whoever is here, and me too, right now. So the fourth step is the hard work, man. You think that we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator at 2 and 3, but you know when it happens, and even in 4, it's in 5, believe it or not. So the fourth step, when I give these workshops in person, I have this whole big like board and all the columns are written on it. But I'm assuming you guys can read, and that you can go to page 65 and look at how it's done. And the thing with the four step is it's a fact finding process. And when I bring my ladies over and they do their fourth, I keep reminding them of that. Because what they want to do, what we all want to do, is write our autobiography. This is not an autobiography. It's a fact-finding, fact-facing process. And that word, unsalable goods, we want to find the unsalable. A better way to say it, so we would understand it, is unsellable. What am I holding on to that is rotten? That's what we want to know. And then the fifth step, mostly because I have a short attention span, I'm assuming, but it seems to help them a lot, is, as my ladies are reading me the fifth step, they, again, want to explain why they're mad at that guy. And I'm like, no, facts only. Because the thing is, if I start going into the history, all of a sudden I'm in blame. And I want to talk a lot about blame. Because we all come in here and are convinced the world did us wrong. We could... Each of us, man. And you know what? It's not a lie. You know what I mean? Like, it's a perception for sure. But in many times, it's not a lie. I mean, I grew up in a horrible place, a savage place, and a horrible abuse. But my father was rich and famous, and he would have international acclaim. And he was on the list once to be considered as the attorney or as the Surgeon General of the United States. But he'd come home and rape my mother. Do you know? And so we had this fierce secret. And then when he left with his money, we were poor and hungry. And then it really got worse. Then because of my mom's alcoholism, stuff went down that happened to little girls, like shouldn't be happening to little girls or any little kiddo. And so I came in here, fists raised, man. And all I could say was, all I could think was, it's my mother's fault. I wouldn't be an alcoholic if those things hadn't happened. If she hadn't let those men in my room, if she hadn't just turned, if she hadn't said, just don't tell anybody, If that had happened to you, you'd drink too. And you know what? That wasn't a lie, but it was not serving me well. Those things almost killed me that happened, but I was then allowing them in sobriety to try to kill me again. And it was going to be up to me, once I barely made it into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be the one to save me. It wasn't going to be up to my mom. It was going to be up to God and me and Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a part in our literature that talks, says we drop the word blame from our speech entirely. And the thing is, it doesn't say it in past tense. It doesn't say we dropped the word blame from our speech like back then when we used to blame entirely. It's a constant process. Like, I don't know people. I mean, I guess there are, whatever works for you, but I do way more than one fourth step. Way more, because God will constantly disclose. It doesn't say, again, past tense. When you're new, you get to close to the one time, Like, I don't even have the same brain I had when I was new, or when I did my first, fourth, or second, or fifth, or seventh, or whatever. And I want freedom. I deserve freedom. My family deserves me to find freedom. Their world is better. My sponsor deserves me to find freedom. So I don't call her, with the same mess I had at 1 year sober, So I came in here, like I said, at 17, savage, crossing my arms, tattoos on my big toes, one of the Bloister cult cross, with the hook on the end, and the other with the Rolling Stones lips. I'm hanging out because I'm gonna make a gang now. And oh my God, just freaking annoying, coming late on purpose, like my sweet sister Holly said, showing body parts that should be never seeing the light of day. And you would not indeed want them to at this point at 57 years old. I am just saying. But, you know, I was just savage and feral, and I had brain damage. I'm actual brain damage. And so I just sit, man, in the back of the rooms, and I'd look at you people. But the thing is, you caught my eye with that hope, with that light, with that warm thing that felt like maybe family. And so I could stay. I could stay for that. And it was a safe place. Not one man tried to hit on me. I mean, I cannot stress that enough. I was looking for a reason to leave. I was looking for a reason to die. Suicide was a strong option B until I was at least 7 years sober. So don't tell me, you know, what chases you out of AA will chase you back in. It'll chase me out of AA and I'd have died. If any of you have ever gotten anything out of anything I've said in the last 40 years of me being in AA, you can thank the men and the women who had a strong home group and decided that their vulnerable newcomers would be safe and sacred in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was about 5 years sober, and I, please don't do this, before I fell in love with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and fell in love with that fourth step in particular, and particular the fourth column, because that's where I got to see where I was wrong. It's the only thing I can do anything about. It's the steps to freedom and to a new world and to finally be able to maybe raise my head and look you in the eye, even at an angle in the beginning, even for a second, and have to look away. But I could begin because of 4 and 5, only because of 4 and 5. In 5, it says we begin to feel the nearness of our creator. Isn't that funny? Isn't that funny that it's at 5? Why 5? It's because God has skin on. That's why. Why in step 5 can't I just say this stuff to myself and to God? God's almighty. God's all powerful. Only God can remove my defects of character. Why not just to God? You know why? Because we don't live in heaven. We live right on here, on the ground with our boots on and our tiaras all askew. And we got to be shoulder to shoulder with our people. Here's the thing. So I'm about 5 years sober, and I'm just like maybe thinking that big book might apply to me. And I'm sober only, like Holly said, in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm quoting the big book at people because, you know, using it to weaponize the big book is, you know, the best use of that. So attractive. And I'm wanting to die at night, you know. I was an undergrad then, and I'm like, I'm trying to memorize. Like, I'd pick up my big book, here's one, and I'd like look at it, and then I'd put it down, trying to memorize it, and then I'd look at it. You know, Jesus, God, I'm pretty sure that ain't the point. But I remember I got this sponsor finally, who, so I don't believe. I mean, whatever. I pretty strongly believe or have witnessed that women get women sober, men get men sober, but I have seen the other way work. So, you know, whatever. And there's times and lifestyles and that kind of thing where it would probably work better not to be. What, anyway, whatever. Whatever floats your boat, do it. Just don't hurt anybody on the way. But I was in the middle of Nebraska, and I had 5 years of sobriety, and this is going to sound crazy to you, but I had the most time of any woman in that whole town, 5 years. And my old probation officer and his wife moved to town, and because I was finally desperate and willing at the same time, I asked him to sponsor me, and she would help me too. And I didn't know then, I didn't even know there was a concept of having a sponsor out of town. Now I've had a sponsor far away forever, for I don't know, 20 years probably. But so one time, so I'm in front of my old sponsor Bill, and he'd only been sponsoring me for 1 week, and I hadn't yet, you know, opened the big book, done, you know, until it's memorized, so you could be so impressed. And I hadn't yet, you know, he didn't know that I hadn't done a real four step out of the big book. He didn't know that I'd never done a real fist up, you know, out of the big book. I'd never said those words to him. So I'm sitting in front of him, and the world is falling apart. Now, I don't remember what it was, but I'm sure at that point, if it was falling apart, it was man of the week, who again would not marry me. They never knew we were engaged, but whatever. So I'm in front of him, world's falling apart. He interrupts me, and what he says to me is this. He says, you know that feeling in your gut that you're not quite like the rest of us? I said, yeah. He said, that's because you haven't done a fourth and fifth step out of the big book. And he was right again. And so I did. And wow. I had this organ of hate for what those men had done, and for my mother who'd thrown me away to them. And I didn't want it anymore. I didn't want it anymore. It felt so normal, though, up to that point. It almost felt like a friend. Like, what am I going to do if I'm not full of hate? What will be left of me? And I could no longer, I didn't have the energy anymore to just keep planting my flag on what they did, what they did, what they did. And it was not, like I said, serving me anymore. And so I did my first four step out of the big book, and wow. And after some successive ones, because I wanted peace, man. And I would find that, you know, what's your part in some of this horrible stuff that goes down when you're kids? You know, there isn't one, but the one that I found that gave me peace was this, that thousands of miles away from anyone who had harmed me, decades away from anything that had gone down, I, in this life, in this day, still allowed what had been done to me to affect who I was and how I reacted on a daily basis. Now that I could see, that was on me. And that I could finally do something about that. And I got my first chink, my first glimpse, my first feeling of freedom. And I began to untense just a little bit. On page 66 is my mantra, what I do with my ladies that I sponsor when they come in for their first step, which is we do it at one time, and it's a lot. It's the doctor's opinion and the first three chapters of the big book. And at the end of that, I ask them to come up with a mantra out of AA literature that will come to them, that will bring them back to sanity, that because alcoholism is alive and vibrant and organic and stronger than we are. Bill Wilson called it another higher power. Bill Wilson said we have two, alcohol and God, and only God is stronger than alcohol. And I asked them, come up with a mantra, man, because alcoholism is after you. It's after all of us. So those times when we're weak, usually 3 a.m, I don't know what is a witching hour. When alcohol is speaking to you, you got to have some kind of piece of sanity that you know, have it be four paragraphs. You're not going to come up with four paragraphs, one quick line, a few words, something to speak sanity back. So mine comes from page 66, the part where it says, if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious, questionable luxury of normal men. It's not even good for them, but they won't die of it, is the point. But for alcoholics, these things are poison. My mantra to speak back to alcoholism is, these things are poison. And it brings me right back to reality, right back to the reality of, oh, I'm on God's path. Oh, I'm going to be okay. Oh, pain will never kill me. Oh, no such thing. I mean, what is this people saying? What is that thing they say? What is it? You can't be, if you have faith, you won't have fear. That is such a load of crap. I mean, what do you think heroes are? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm a historian. Like, I have my graduate degree in history. I know all kinds of stories about heroes, men and women, you know, big people, small people, and all of them were afraid. What the hell? Just keep moving forward is all, because that's what courage is, man. That's the stuff warriors are made of, looking at this stuff, saying this stuff out loud. There's another part in here that says, page 66, to conclude that others were wrong were as far as most of us got. That's as far as I got, and it was killing me. It was killing me. And I believe in this thing, and I call it the truth beyond the truth. Because, yeah, I mean, it's true. Those things went down. Or, yeah, it's true. On this day, there's a lady in my home group that gossips about me. Yeah, it's true. Somebody may, you know, shouldn't have done whatever annoyed me or hurt me or something. But the truth beyond the truth is they're just doing the best they can, too. The truth beyond the truth is I have done far worse than the thing that's bugging me about whatever they did. That's the truth beyond the truth. And I always know it is because it gives me peace. When my sponsees come over, they do step one. The next week they come over, we do two and three straight out of the big book. The next week's the big day because they're at my house and we start early. They write their four step right there at my house. Right there, same day, they do their fifth step. Right there, same day, 6 and 7. They have 8 in hand. They add to 8. They have 1 week to do step 9 because we are rolling. We are rolling. I don't understand this thing about, you know, take it slow. No, don't. Alcoholism is not taking it slow. You know who wants you to take it slow? Alcoholism, who, coincidentally, also wants to kill you. Bill didn't take it slow. Evie didn't take it slow. Dr. Bob certainly didn't take it slow. I'm reading that new AA history book that Holly tells me is over 800 pages long. I don't want to look at how many pages because it'll be like intimidating, but it talks over and over and over again how Dr. Bob would, like, new guys would show up at his house and he'd take them through all the steps in one weekend. And I used to be a lazy sponsor. I'm sorry, but that was my motive. But I would do like one step a month. And I wondered why, how come there's nobody else to sponsor? How come all these women are drinking? Because they don't have a foundation. These things give us a foundation. How can you tell someone how to do a foursome? How can you tell someone what a sex inventory is or a fear inventory is if you haven't done it? We've got to share this message. We've got to have depth and weight, man. People know we're the biggest cons in the world. We can smell a lie. So we've got to do this work so we have it. The fear inventory that comes in the four step always confused me for the longest time. It just seemed so random and weird. Like, okay, write down, I'm afraid of flying and snakes. I mean, what? But then there'd be deeper things too. I was afraid of someone winning. I was afraid of being taken advantage of. I was totally, absolutely afraid of how people saw me. But it just seemed so weird. Then you just read it and it was kind of like, okay, now what? But the why what is because, remember, just coming up right over the next hill is 6 and 7. You will have a list of what to turn to God. Here you go, God. Just the facts. In the, I have an ex-husband. I mean, that's more a normal thing, I think. I have a current husband, St. Richard. We've been together 22 years, and he's amazing. He's fabulous. And my first husband was Boy Meets Girl on AA campus. And I was pregnant in 2 months. And that's when I found out he was, though he said he had 10 years of sobriety, he was like drinking codeine. Why am I laughing? But because I'm so stupid. That's why. And but I was pregnant and desperate and working at a Catholic school while I was in grad school. And I mean, pregnant girls are not going to make it, you know, with that kind of a job. And so I married them, man, and it got worse fast. And, you know, I could waste your time and, you know, tell you about him, you know, awful thing, him pushing me into walls. I mean, bad things, really. But here's the deal, man. Just like in the fourth column, where am I to blame? I married him. Me, not even drunk. Like, I was like 12 or 13 years sober. Me. And I was the grown-up on the ground, and I still did that. What did I think? All of a sudden, he was going to be this great guy? You know, what the hell? Heck. So we divorced, and I had 2 kids in diapers, and, you know, though I was sober that time by about 16 or 17 years, I didn't have a mom. You know, she was drunk, and people in AA taught me how to be a mom, I swear to God. And it was before the state at that time took over garnishing child support. So before I had that paperwork in motion, I had to wait for my ex to send the child support. And it was supposed to be in my mailbox by the 3rd of every month. And it was always late. And so around the 1st of the month, I started getting mad. He's going to be late. I just know he's going to be late. And then, so like, 48 hours now wasted, because then the 3rd would come and I'd be at the window watching every month for the mail, and then I'd go stomping out there and it wasn't there, and oh my God, every month was like this, and then like more 7 more days till he, you know, felt like sending it, and I was giving him the satisfaction. But here's the thing, I was so angry, and then it just hit me like a freaking light bulb. It was like, oh, he's going to be late with the child support. Oh, all right. And it was all good, done. No more mess. Like, oh, all right. That's how that rolls. Okay. So it's, you know, a lot of it is my own expectation. A lot of it is, where, you know, if I want the gifts of this program, if I want the gifts of this, hard and frightening, work will pay off, then I got to take it to, I got to be the grown up on the ground. You know, that's how I forgave my mother and my father and the men who had harmed me. And I, you know, I just realized that, you know, cause you know, they didn't change, you know, even though I got sober. Huh? And, I just realized like, oh, I'm the one in AA. I'm the one with the 12 steps to recovery. More is expected of me. I'm the grown up on the ground. And I never expected them to be grown up. I never even expected it. No shade at all. I just didn't expect it. So like if they did something like that a grown up would do, I'd be like, oh my God, that's so nice. And I mean, expectations. And that fourth column, man, gave me that. Now let's sum up about sex. And so the sex inventory is tough, man, because it's, you're doing a whole other inventory as thorough as the first part of it, which was the first four columns. And so, I mean, I'm kind of a mama bear and I don't have, so when my sponsees used to tell me stuff about the bad guy, that's, I would only see the first truth. I wouldn't see the truth beyond the truth. Like, well, what did you do? Or why are you staying? You know what I mean? Like the real truth that they could do something about. I'd be all upset. And I'd like tell them the next steps of their lives. And, you know, oddly enough, people don't really like that. And they would never do it. And then usually this, you know, the sponsorship relationships would blow up because I had burned the bridge. By telling them what they should do and then expecting the worst, expecting them to do it. So now here's what I do. I just read the sex inventory pretty much and it changed my sponsorship. Now, when one of my ladies is having a hard time in a relationship or, you know, they maybe did something they're not proud of or are thinking about doing something, you know, that they maybe are feeling a little shady about. Only thing I say is, well, I say a couple things. I say, well, when we did your sex inventory, I don't really remember, but was that the ideal that you wanted to grow toward? And if they say no, then I'll say, well, then, you know, you have your answer. And then the other thing I ask and say to them is this. Well, I say a couple of things. I'll say, so in the higher power that you chose, you know, however that is for you, is this thing that happened to you, is that what that higher power would want for you? And if they say no, then I say, well, then you have your answer. And then sometimes it's just heartbreaking, right? You know what I mean? And how, what I learned from my fabulous sponsor, the Miss Polly P, I've heard her say this, and this is what I'll say too, because it's the truth beyond the truth. And the truth is when one of my girls gets heartbroken or something, you know, they put themselves in a position to be hurt or they're just hurt is I'll say, oh, honey, I could cry right now thinking about it. I say, I just can't wait for the day that you love yourself as much as God and I love you. And that's the truth beyond the truth. And that's all my job is, man. I got to keep the bridge built. I got to do this foundational work and I got to keep the bridge built. I'm going to tell this quick story. I won't tell the whole details, but I still had at 13, 14, you know, 13 years sober, I still had that, the organ of hate. And now my life was in stress. So, you know, I had those babies and that bad husband, you know, that difficult husband. And so I went into labor with my first son and it went bad and he was dying. And he was born not breathing and they worked on him for a long time in that room that was silence that weighed a ton. And finally they got him breathing and it was weak. And even I, an experienced mother, could know that I knew something was wrong. And they put that sweet baby boy who I'd been in labor with for 36 hours in my arms. And I looked down, man, and I saw my son. I saw he was perfect, beautiful. And out of nowhere, my very next thought were of the men who had entered my bedroom when I was a little girl and harmed me. And I realized for the first time that those men had been perfect and beautiful too. Who better than me to have compassion? Another monster had entered their life and turned them into monsters. And I was free. And I knew too about my mother in that moment as well, that there had been a day when they placed one of those babies in her arms on the day of their birth, and she looked down on that perfect and beautiful baby and meant with every fiber of her being to protect him. But alcoholism entered, and it's a power beyond her. And she couldn't protect him. And the monster got in and turned him. And I was free. To this day, I think the magic really of that fourth column is it gives us compassion. I think that's a magical asset. I think it's this a spiritual tool that works under all conditions. In step five, it's interesting. You would think that in the 12 by 12 and in the big book, step five would say just this. Now read what you just wrote. On to six. But it doesn't. It's a lot of pages. Why it's so important is here is the place. Here is actually where we begin to stand shoulder to shoulder. Here it is where we feel the nearness of our Creator. Here it is where we can look the world in the eye. By telling that stuff, by not minimizing it. And I'll tell you this, I take my girls to the big book. I go to big book studies. I go to big book conferences. I do workshops on the big book. And I know a lot about the big book. But I mean, we all do. That's no big deal. You know, we can read, for instance. But I mean, it's rare in here for it to use that heavy stick of do this or die. You know, if I had written, it would be every other phrase because I'm dramatic. But one of the places that it says it is in the fifth step. You wouldn't think that to be true. You think it would be all over the first step, wouldn't you? But it's also in the fifth step. So I tell my biggest lesson about that is my friend Pat, when I went to undergrad, he was this cool guy, coolest guy in the world, man. And 32 years of sobriety. I had about 4 or 5 years. And he had been a veteran in World War II, and because I'm a historian. He would tell me horror stories about things that he had seen during World War II, and because he knew I understood about the war. And but he'd end every phrase, he'd say, "Paula, but there's one thing I'll never tell." And I was like, "God dang, what could that be?" You know, because he had told me awful things. And man, for years I wondered what that thing could be. And I've started to write short stories about what that thing could be, but. The other thing about Pat is he had a resentment. And here it is also back and forward. It says resentments are infinitely grave. You know, grave means like in a grave, as in you're dead and buried. Infinitely, infinitely. Pay attention to that word. Doesn't mean like for a little bit or a little while. Infinite. The universe is infinite. God is infinite. I can't think of another thing that's infinite. Those are the only two I know. Well, the universe is the only one we like know. So infinite. Like there's no limit to how lethal resentments are. The other thing though, I want to say this, and I mean, I would never change the big book. There's one thing that I would add though, I would say self-pity is as dangerous because man, that stuff feels good. And it's true, you know? But I have seen self-pity change the physiology of someone's neurons, I swear to God, and he'd let it go too long and he never came back. It drove him literally crazy. So self-pity is powerful stuff. As easily rationalized as resentments. But so about Pat, you know, so he also had a resentment against his clubhouse manager. And a year after I moved out of Nebraska, I got a call that Pat, with 32 years of sobriety, had started drinking. He was dead in a year. And I got off the phone to my other little friend who'd known him in undergrad. And I said, "Pat's drinking." And she said, "You know what it was? It was that resentment." I said, "You know what it was? It was that secret." And I have a graduate degree in history. I've had to learn about World War II. And I always say this. I wish I didn't always say this, but it's so true. It's there are things that I wish I didn't know. There's things that is actually too much. It's too much. And there's research I honestly wish I had not read. Mostly, not all, but mostly about the funny line, the funny fuzzy line between enemy and ally and the things done in the fog of war. And and always about what was that secret Pat would not tell. Now I know. I would bet every dollar that I have that the thing that Pat would not say at 32 years of sobriety is not something that he saw in that horrible conflict. It was something that he did. And the shame and the hate and the blocking himself off from his fellow man and the half measure on the fifth step and that secret took 32 years to kill such a man. But in the end, that is what killed him. Tell your secrets. Don't be minimizing your secrets. If it killed such a man, a hero, a giant of a man, you don't stand a chance. Here's the thing. I realized a long time ago, I was about 22 years sober. And I mean, I don't know. I don't believe. I mean, whatever. People say, you know, like deaths come in threes. Or I mean, I don't even know. It just seemed to be a time like a lot of people dropping dead. Like people I knew, but like famous people too. And I don't know what it was about all that, but it's like gave me this awareness of, man, who knows when my, who knows? I could die tonight. And it just with the same awareness came that I don't want to do anything in this whole day that I'm either going to regret by that I did it or that I didn't do it. I do not want to put my head on the pillow tonight with regret. Regret is the worst. This story about Pat and secrets and that it killed him, and I also have outside issues which don't belong in AA and whatever AA gathering, I guess. But I'm just saying, you know, for a millisecond, because my sponsor does. I have PTSD, post traumatic stress disorder, and which didn't surprise me or my sponsor. And I have depression, but when they show up these days, they don't, you know, take over my life and everyone's life around me. I just look at them and say, "Oh, it's you. Buckle up." So, but because most of the time from the podium, I'll say, you know, the story about Pat and his secrets and his war experiences and that I know war and that I'll say something about my PTSD and its diagnosis twice now. You know how there's a thank you line in, you know, conferences? I forgot to start my timer. Hilarious. Dang it, I always do that. But anyway. No, that's just made me go blank. Oh. So twice now in the thank you line, I have been pulled out of the thank you line by soldiers back from war into, you know, some corner with two chairs, and they told me their secrets. And I'm just so grateful. I just like only in God's world, you know, how else but redefined, refired, cracked and then made good again, could that have happened? Could my experiences, my PTSD that came not from that kind of war, but here anyway, and my knowledge, my freaking graduate degree in history, I mean, how could, and Pat's tragic story, and all together they came, and I'm willing to share them, and I'm not happy to share about PTSD. I mean, you know, who, you know, wants to wear a sign with that on it, but but it's the truth, and that's all I got, man. That's all I got, and that has helped them. And I'll say, I rarely say this, but it's here, so I'm going to say it is. I know when I speak at these conferences, man, I know my audience. I know, and I always knew that one of these days there was going to be a pedophile that might want to talk to me. And that day happened, and I told the same story as I just told you, and he came up to me at the end of the thank you line and asked if there was a time that we could talk, and so we did. And he had done things in when he was drunk, that he just couldn't live with, you know. And I mean, I always wondered how I'd react, you know, because that's my darkness, you know. I was on the other end of that. And I held him, and I've never seen him sob so much, not even those soldiers with their horrible war stories. I mean, oh, my God, that man. And I just told him my experience, you know, and I was able to guide him toward help. And he'll text me every once in a while. I mean, it's freaking amazing. Like, he went from, broken, you know, to just tell him the full truth, not that half truth, like Pat would tell the half truth. But there's one thing I'll never tell. That's a half truth. But man, when we tell the whole truth, wow. That's where God lives, man. That's the land of heaven. Who knew, man? We all came in here like Sweet Holly was talking, and we just knew something was wrong with us. We just knew it. Come to find out, we just belong together, that's all. And it's telling our secrets, man. It can save somebody else. That's the deal. Like, it was years before I told I had PTSD. I don't know why it took me so long, you know? But, and then how I was diagnosed is this whole other long story I'm not going to go into, but it's a miracle. I mean, I'm a scientifically declared miracle. And I mean, you know, and not one woman that asked me to sponsor me ever, not one time ever, has come up to me and said, "You are so perfect. I want what you have." Trust me, never once. Whatever. You know, as Polly says, we are a shoulder-to-shoulder bunch, you know? I don't need fake. I mean, you know, it's just not helpful. And I mean, a lot of sometimes, you know, about to call, you know, if I can't get a hold of Polly, I'll call like Carla or Holly or, you know, somebody, you know, that I'm close to and respect like that. And I'll be like, "Polly, you've got 40 years. You should not be thinking this." But, you know, my secrets will kill me. And poor Pat, you know, we can learn from what people did. That's great. And we can learn from what they didn't do. And, you know, that'll save our lives too. So I'm telling it, you know, I'm telling it, and I'm telling about my outside issues. And I want to talk for a little bit about step five, and that step five brings us a measure of humility. And we don't even know what that word looks like until we get there. And I mean, we see it, we glimpse it a little bit in three. And then as we're saying, you know, writing some of that stuff in four, there's just God hard even to write it out loud on paper. But step five, man, brings us a measure of humility. And I'm telling you, I know it's not my step, and I don't like when speakers step on the other steps, but I'm doing it for half a second. And in step seven, are the most powerful words, I think for now anyway, in AA literature. And it says this: we found humility to be the healer of pain. What? Not even happiness, joyousness, and freedom. Does it say that's the healer of pain? And you know what else it says? Pain is the touchstone of all progress. Hear the word. Not a little bit of progress. Not some of the progress. All the progress. And it doesn't just say that because we almost died because we were drunk all the time. It goes on. I mean, it is all over the 12 by 12. In every step, almost. There's some phrase of that. And then seven, we found humility to be the healer of pain. It wasn't drinking, thought it was that. It wasn't, you know, being at a retreat and, you know, praying, though those are great, you know. Humility. And if five can bring me a measure of that, sign me up. I find that my defects will evolve and morph and wear a different skin, but it's the same damn thing. You know, it's judging other people. It's wanting to feel superior to other people. It's excluding people so I feel superior. It's excluding them before they can exclude me. It's all this stuff. Just think of junior high, and there you go. So I'm going to say this, and I think I'll probably shut up in a second. And that is that, though I have my book all marked up, I mean, this was really going to be a great talk. But, what was I going to say? I don't even remember. I wasn't meant to be. So I live in a small town. Well, I mean, it's kind of small town, but it's a small AA town. And I'm the woman with the most time only because it's a small town. And you know, I take some hits and I give them two. And so I had to take on a predator that nobody else was interested in doing anything about, and we were losing women, and he was following women home, and he wasn't the only one. And it's a culture where I live. Actually, it's been going on so long. Men with 40, 45 years are picking up on the newcomer women, And they're teaching the newer men coming in how to do that. Now that's fine. And nobody will say anything. Well, I had a responsibility. So I said something. And I was not popular. And I had very much enjoyed being popular. But I'm still not popular. And I don't care. It had to be done. I had to stand shoulder to shoulder with the newcomers. So that's what I did. And it was the right thing to do. But what I want to say is, you know, I said this, I think, just yesterday, but, you know, you always hear that thing that when we're in the rooms, in the, you know, being sober, that alcoholism is out in the parking lot doing push-ups. So I think, yeah, but I also think it changes, it's changed and morphed and evolved. And here's what I think now, when I judge how another meeting runs, when I judge how somebody else is sober, when I start sentences with, well, I don't want to take anybody's inventory, but, or south of the Mason-Dixon line, say something horrible about somebody and then end it with, bless her heart. Or, oh my God, when I gossip about something AA, when I judge a sponsorship line, hello, shut up. When I, you know, like crazy, it's craziness, but that doesn't, so alcoholism is not no longer in the parking lot. We open our doors wide, give it a cup of coffee, ask if it wanted some cream, give it a established seat in our room and said, come on in, kill somebody I love. Who do you want next? We got to watch this stuff, man. The longer we're sober, I mean, anytime after the first 24 hours, our responsibility is to keep the bridge built. The bridge built. It is absolutely a program of attractiveness, and there's nothing more attractive than being loving and kind. And having a program of recovery with depth and weight. So I'm going to close. What I want to close with is I had my first son, like I said, at 13 years sober, my second at 15 years sober, and my last at almost 20 years sober. The last one I had was St. Richard, my married to, the one I've been married to so long. And my first two sons are now 26 and 27 years old, and they're dying of alcoholism. And I thought that I was ardent on sticking to the literature and singleness of purpose before, but now that I need instinctually for these rooms to be here in the format that has worked for 2 million people, now that I need that, I'm even more so in the book, more so in the 4 and 5, straight out of the big book, man. Because I want it, I need it. If they ever reach for help, I need it to be here for them. So I'm going to close with just this part out of step 5 that I love so much. It's in the 12 by 12. And here's what it says. But we soon discovered that while we weren't alone anymore in a social sense, we still suffered many of the old pangs of anxious apartness. Until we had talked with complete candor or of our conflicts and had listened to someone else do the same thing. Did you catch that? Also, hearing at this step is life-changing. Then you are absolutely shoulder to shoulder. We still didn't belong. Here's the answer. It says it right here, the next line. Step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of true kinship with man and God. I thank you so much.